I'm the editor of a magazine, small magazine, 2000 circulation called Film Heritage. And in the 10 years we published, we've gotten more quality articles on your work than anybody else. One of the most recent was a very convincing argument or explanation about the pessimism of frenzy. Now, what is the tone of deceit, which is now the family plot?
Well, I think the general tone is, I would say, colorful and in certain respects amusing. Although it's about kidnapping and the innocent people who get involved in it, it runs on that theme. As a matter of fact, it's really two stories. It's a story of a fake medium and her taxi driver come actor partner who is her research man, so that if she goes into a rich old lady for a seance, she's got all the material provided for by him. So that's how the fakery is accomplished. You see, she comes out with certain facts about her client, and the client is astonished that she knows so much. Now, they're charged with the job of tracing a missing heir, hopefully through psychic means. So you get the innocents setting out to trace a missing heir. Meanwhile, a number of kidnappings have taken place by a rather sophisticated couple, and they hide their victims for ransom in a house right in the middle of the city, not on a lonely moor as they would have it in the movies. And the two stories gradually meet and get together.
Which film tonally or...
As you hear, they're ready to... They've kidnapped a bishop, you see, from a cathedral in front of the whole congregation, based on the theory that if anything happens in a cathedral, you don't exactly get up and start screaming and yelling. People just wonder what's going on. And he's whisked out in no time, because they usually stick them with sodium pentotol and carry them out. Well, now we've just reached a point that you've probably heard the dialogue, telling the bishop they're ready and they're just going in to administer the sodium pentotol. And at that moment the front door bell rings, and it's the medium who've tracked down, innocently, they think, a missing heir, just as they're about to deliver the bishop. So that's the apex of the two stories. But it's all done, I would say, in a fairly light, amusing manner. Sophisticated, but not at all heavily melodramatic.
Would you agree that Frenzy is a pessimistic picture?
Well, yes, because Frenzy, you see, dealt with a sex maniac. You see, that was a little more serious.
Well, this guy argues that marriage, one can't find solace in marriage anymore. In that film, the marriages are...
Right, that's true. And the... Well, in this film, we don't even indicate whether people are married or not. You know, they're just living, everybody's living together in this film. Well, that's a sign of the times.
I was talking to Charlie, I was listening to the dialogue at one point, and then we moved up when you reshot it and looked at the faces, and the dialogue is really menacing, but Devane's smile, it's kind of lighter.
Well, it is, you see, it is. After all, the act of kidnapping is a menacing thing. And not only that, But this man, who is the kidnapper, he really runs a jewelry store in the city. But he has a past. He, as a boy of 16, set fire to the house while he locked his foster parents in a room with the help of another boy, the two of them. Well, one went on, went abroad and did well. The other stayed behind in the village and now runs the garage. So they both have guilt. And this man uses his boyfriend of years ago to actually try and kill these two innocent people. And it's the dramatizing of coincidence. For example, one of the clues for the seekers is that the original parson who baptized the foster child, or whatever it was, has now become a bishop. So when the kidnapping takes place, he's observed to be at the end of the church, and he's innocently saying to the verger, "I'd like to see the bishop, to ask him some questions." At that moment, the kidnapping takes place. And our kidnappers have already observed the medium and her boyfriend through the garage man. So there's they figure that they drive away with the bishop in the back of the car, wondering, how the hell did this man get here? Do you believe in ESP? And, well, they know she's a spiritualist. And they're bewildered. The kidnappers themselves are completely bewildered as to why this man is present in the cathedral. So therefore, you do get an attempt to kill them by tampering with the brakes of their car in the mountains. So you get a wild ride of a car with no brakes. Well, even that is treated comically, although they're in danger of going over the side any minute, which I've shot up in the mountains here. So it's got a lot of colour, but wherever I can, you know, I turn it to amusement rather than heavy-handed melodrama.
I don't know whether you do this, but what film does it remind you of that you...
Well, you could go back as far as a film, we'll say, like The Lady Vanishes.
Sure.
Well, there you had the kidnapping of an old lady, but the whole thing was treated with comedy. And that's the essence of this film, is that it's treated in a very sophisticated way.
I've seen the French magazine with color photos of you, and I've seen George Perry's book with color photos of you. Are you becoming glamour puss now?
I don't know. I don't do anything. There's Sue there.
These are beautiful
books. Does she have a cigar?
I can't repeat exactly the line of dialogue, but tell me this. It was in North by Northwest, and when they created this person who didn't really exist, a woman at the table says, "If it weren't so horrible, I could almost laugh." Do you remember that line?
Vaguely, yes, yeah. Yes.
What would you say that is in terms
of...
Well,
she's really saying, if the risk of his life weren't so awful, I would laugh at the situation that the man finds himself in. Cary Grant is mistaken for a man who is non-existent.
Do you feel that way?
Well, it's a comic situation, you know, it's just as much as...
But there is that menace to it.
Oh, the menace is always under the... You know, after all, suspense as such. See, in this situation, the medium goes around the side door to the garage when they're ready to deliver the bishop. And he falls out of the car, and the medium sees him. And my God, the bishop. And she realizes she's face to face with a kidnapper. Well, they grab her and they try and stab her and put her out because they've got a 30-minute deadline to deliver the bishop and pick up the ransom. So they're fighting against time. Well, that's very dramatic for a moment, but you don't, because you have a dramatic story, you don't have to play into it, but you play contrapuntal behavior patterns and characters. Like, after all, film I made years ago, 39 Steps. Well, hell, you have a stabbing of a woman at the beginning. But the sophisticated attitude of the man gave the film a different tone.
A lot of people have said that that you and the audience, I don't know whether you do, but the audience is supposed to sympathize, in a sense, with the killer. They want him to get away.
She didn't have one, she's gone today.
Well, thank you. In frenzy. No, I didn't feel that way. But
well, audiences are very strange, you know. For example, if you see, say, a burglar in the bedroom of a well-to-do woman and he's stealing her jewelry, then you cut to the front door of her coming in. They want him to get away. They say, quick, you're going to get caught. And they don't sympathize with the victim at all. You know, it's like in any murder situation. The victim is the last person they ever think about. They're always thinking about, will the murderer get off? Will he get life? Or he's, everything about him is looked into and examined. But the poor victim is just disposed of.
Even more today, I think.
Unless it's a racehorse like the one the other day, then there was great sympathy there.
Why didn't they, in frenzy, maybe I've got it wrong, but why didn't the cops take the fingerprints off the potato truck?
I'm not sure.
He wasn't wearing gloves, I don't think.
No, but I think by that time the truck had been dealt with. I think the thing that they went after was the potato dust on the man. You see, they didn't... You see, when you take fingerprints, you see, obviously, even if they'd have done so, this man, being a sex maniac, had no prison record. You see? And even if you leave your fingerprints on, well, what are you going to compare them with? Now, this man makes a mistake when the bishop says, can I keep that book? He says, without fingerprints on it. Well, actually, that's an unnecessary statement. He only says it because he is not an established criminal, or he's, shall we term the phrase, he's an uncaught criminal. So that taking fingerprints is only good if you discover in the files the fingerprints which match of an already established criminal.
Yeah, but you work very much on suspension of disbelief in every film, and we in the audience do suspend our disbelief instead of I don't know what.
Well, let me, I have a phrase, you know, that I say to myself, logic is dull. It is. You know, a lot of foot is devoted to making a thing logic. But there's no drama going on at the time. At all.
Mm-hmm. The question that I asked Howard Hawks, and I wanted to ask you in a sense, what did you feel when you had a vision, not something to say, but that wasn't a superficial picture, that your films had depth and levels, and the audience didn't recognize it? Did that ever bother you? Now, the critics have come and have discovered what Alfred Hitchcock, some of the things that he represents. But the audience...
No, they take it on the surface. What was it Sam Goldwyn once said? Messages are for Western Union.
But don't your films have a message? Not a big message, not in big lights.
Well... they usually follow a pattern of the innocent man being involved in bizarre situations. Self-plagiarism is style.
T.S. Eliot said, you steal but you leave your own fingerprints on something.
Mm-hmm.
What about the ending to the guy who worked for Sherman Billingsley?
And that, oh, the wrong man?
Yeah. Now that seems like the tone is absolutely pessimistic, and then there's almost a grafted ending on of upbeat. 2 years later, she was released from the sanitarium and they lived happily ever after. What happened?
Well, I think that was, we were just doing a true story.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely. We followed everything. As a matter of fact, if there was anything wrong with that picture, I would say that the director had imposed himself too much on it.
How so?
Because I put in directorial touches which never happened in the real story. In the real story, the real man was ultimately caught in a delicatessen store. But I didn't do it that way. I showed Henry Fonda's face looking at a picture of Christ on the wall and murmuring a prayer. And slowly I dissolved a street scene over Fonda's face and a man walking toward the camera. And as he got nearer the camera, his face superimposed itself over the face of Henry Fonda. So that I was really cinematically indicating the resemblance between the two. I should never have done that. And how clever one may have thought one was being. That never happened in the real story. And that was the error. If you're doing a documentary type picture, then it's wrong to be fictitious.
In other words, you think that film would work better with basic simplicity, just stick to the facts?
In that type of film, definitely. See, it's the manner of telling, you know, if you tell it cinematically. The trouble, you know, with a lot of films are what I call photographs of people talking. I can do it visually, so much the better.
How about Bruce Dern? Tell me something about Bruce Dern. Do you think he's a star and he's a great actor, but do you think he'll be a big star?
Well, there's always room for another Gary Cooper type, you know.
You think Dern is a Gary Cooper type?
No, I'm not saying he's a Gary Cooper type, but I mean, who would have said that Gary Cooper ever would have become a star when he first came on? Nobody knew. They all have to grow up. Dan is a very accomplished actor, and a great sense of comedy, too. Yeah, I've used you before, years ago.
Yeah, Charlie told me that he was in Marnie, and I didn't,
yeah,
I didn't
he
know.
He was also in some of our television shows.
Oh, he was. Mm. Now, did you find a comedy then, or did you know, he's always kind of, not always, but he can be bizarre, and he can be...
Sinister.
Yeah, sinister, exactly.
Well, I knew him, and I knew that he could play sinister. I know he did a TV show where he really was a horror. I forget the girl in it. It was in a peach field in Georgia. The Trees Are Right, was it? That's right, yes. But I knew him personally, and you know they have a sense of humor. And of course, thank God, he's not the typical leading man. He's a character actor, really. Just the same with Barbara Harris. Both our leads are character people. I think that's the trend. Away from the Clark Gables and Ronald Colemans that we used to have. Think of in the late 20s or early 30s. People would say, oh, he's another Ronald Colemans. You know, I always remember an actress, English actress, Lillian Braithwaite, her name was. And she was one of those grande dames of which the English stage is full of, or not full of, sprinkled with. And a man, I don't know whether the name in any of you, Basil Dean.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he was a leading stage producer in London.
How do I spell?
D-A-N, Basil D. Oh, he was one of the biggest London producers in his day. He's in his 80s now. And I'm talking about, you know, copying Ronald Colemans or Clark Gable or what have you. He married a girl called Victoria Hopper, a little blonde actress. And like, you know, used to put her in leads, like Selznick did Jennifer Jones, you know. And a play opened called The Mask of Virtue. And it was the first appearance of Vivian Leigh on the stage. And at a party afterwards, this girl Hopper, Dean's wife, you know, wasn't all that much of an actress. And somebody made a remark about Vivian Leigh, said, oh, you know, she reminds me a lot of Victoria Hopper. And this old dame said, do we want another Victoria Hopper? Real caustic.
When you were on the Tom Snyder show, I absolutely winced when he said to you, do you ever crack a joke?
All the time.
Yes, of course.
Sure.
And it seemed like that he wasn't prepared, or he didn't... How did that interview go? Because I just couldn't watch it. It hurt, you know.
Yeah, I can't remember it now. Oh, I think, what was it Henry Fonda once said of me, I believe. I don't know whether he told it to somebody or whether it was in print, I can't remember. He said, just before you're going to do a dramatic scene, he cracks a joke.
You do that intentionally, though, don't you?
Mm-hmm. It depends, you know. It depends on the circumstances. But, you know, I can afford, I suppose, to make a joke whenever I like, because I'm not all that concentrated, because to me the film was already made long ago. When the script was finished, which I worked on with Lehman, the whole creative element is complete. I wish I'd say, well, that's that. Then let's go on to the next script. If you're not, you've got to go through the whole process of making
it. A lot of people think the film is essentially an intuitive act. Do you think it is?
Well, I wouldn't say it. It is intuitive if you've been at it long enough. See, the great point that I continually make is not enough people have a visual sense. They cannot project. See, I don't even look through the camera. Because I can visualize it on the screen. And that's the great difference. It's not what the camera sees. It's what you see on the screen. And it's that white rectangle that has to be filled with imagery, or a succession of images, one after the other. Got nothing to do with the camera at all. It's just as this. And, you know, you can make all kinds of statements without the use of words. The only thing wrong with a silent picture was that people opened their mouths and no sound came out. See, Chaplin was very good in his early days, you know. I remember a film of his, you've probably seen it, The Pilgrim. Well, there you open up with a prison guard pasting a wanted notice on a wall, and it's Chaplin in convict's clothes. The next shot is a man, tall man, coming out of the river, having had a swim, onto the bank, and finally has no clothes, but just convict's clothes left there. The next shot is a railroad depot, people waiting for a train, and they're walking along, is Chaplin, dressed as a parson, with clothes much too long for him, the legs are long and everything else. Well, there are three images. Look what they tell. Well, that's the kind of thing that I believe that belongs to a cinema.
Well, do you allow, a lot of people discover things as they're making the film. Their film is almost accidental. It's fortuitous, mm-hmm. a large part of it. Does this ever happen to you, or
no,
it never happens?
No. You sometimes, very often, you know, there are little slip-ups that happen in the script that you catch when it becomes live on the stage. Now, just now I caught one. And I had four takes, and I had to take a fifth. I had to go back and do it again.
What was it?
Well, a bishop. We saw him kidnapped. We've shown that. He's wearing vestments. You can tell me he's been sitting in this thing with a toilet there and everything else, wearing the vestments all the time? It didn't make sense to me. I suddenly stopped and said, wait a minute. But I had a line here. Have you got your vestments on? Yes.
Ah, but that's logic, isn't it?
It's only logic for a special purpose. I don't want the audience to think that he went to the toilet with vestments on, which a lot of them are liable to do. They've got one of these chemical toilets in that room where he's been incarcerated. When they first showed it to me, I said, that's ridiculous. It's too small, much white, shiny. He said, well, it's the sort of thing that this man will go out and buy because they use these on yachts. I said, I don't care. It's way too low. That audience are going to imagine a tall man sitting all that with his legs sticking up. I said, no, you lift that up about 6 inches. Make it normal height.
You have a lot of faith in the audience? You're saying that they would think about that.
Yes, they do. They pick on the most extraordinary things. You'd be amazed. I'll never forget. There are two occasions that happened to me. I made that film Trouble with Harry. Well, we had an opening with it before the governor. Now, Montpelier is the capital of Vermont. And Barre is the town next to it. They join each other, rather like twin cities, you know. And we had this opening with the governor there at this movie house in Barre, Vermont, and Montpelier next door. And the sheriff in the story on the screen picked up the phone and said, Montpelier 2000, please. Biggest roar of laughter I've ever heard. It happened to be the correct number.
Oh, really?
It was the correct number for the piece.
And purely chance?
Absolutely. What would you do? You'd use the proper number to be correct. But it tickled them. They roared. How do you account for that? Familiarity of it or something. But not one person. 1,500 people. I remember years ago, I was sneaking a picture I made with Cary Grant and Joan Fontaine, Suspicion. Old trend of the story was, is her husband a murderer or not? And that's what the film was all about. Is he a murderer or is he not a murderer? Toward the end of the film, she finds in his coat pocket a letter from an insurance company. And don't forget, she's been suspecting him. And the letter just says, policy number so-and-so, so-and-so, is only payable in the event of your wife's death. She reads the letter and just raises her head and stares out. Belly laugh from the audience. Next thing, I took her close up out and ended on the letter. No laugh, nothing. Now why do they laugh at that? I haven't any idea. Our audiences are very peculiar. I think the most amusing audience story, which is a true one. My assistant, Mrs. Robinson, went to see the film Sweet Charity, went to the matinee, Shirley MacLaine. Behind her were two married couples, young married couples. The lights went on, and one woman said to the other, she heard one say to the other, oh, I do like her, don't you? The other one said, well, I've always liked Barbara Streisand. So one of the husbands says, Barbara Streisand, what are you talking about? She's in Funny Girl. The other one says, well, this is Funny Girl, isn't it? That's all it is.
I asked you originally about the faith in the audience, and you paused, and then we went on something else. Do you have faith in the audience?
Well, I believe in playing with the audience, definitely, especially with suspense. You have to say when you're doing the script, what are the audience thinking now? And you better make sure they're thinking the way you want them to, not the way they want to think. Because you're telling the story, and you're putting them, if it's suspense, putting them through the ringer.
What was the incident that taught you the greatest lesson about the audience?
In a film called The Woman Alone. It was based on a Joseph Conrad story called The Secret Agent, laid around the turn of the century. And in it I had a small boy carry a package across London and held up for reasons. You, the audience, knew the bomb was in that package and it would go off at 1 o'clock. Well, he was stopped here, he stopped there. In fact, the Lord Mayor's show was going to go. He started to run across and the police said, get back, get back. So he stood there with his package under his arm and watched this thing go by. Well, at the end of the procession, the traffic is renewed, but it takes the tempo of the procession. So he got on a bus. This bus is crawling along, policemen stopping it, customers on and off. And I kept photographing this bomb, and the little boy was playing with a puppy in a woman's arms. And I shot this package all directions, and every time I cut, I didn't grind off 100 feet of package and just keep cutting to it. I shot it that way, and give it this vitality. Then I kept shooting clocks, different kind of clocks. 10 minutes of one. Six. 5, 4, 3, 1 o'clock, nothing happened. 1 minute past one, 2 minutes past one, nothing. Relief. 3 minutes past one, up goes the lot, bus and everything. Huge explosion. Well, I remember the critic, the woman critic on the London Observer, I was there at the press show, coming up to me with raised fists. She said, how dare you do a thing like that? She said, I've got a 5-year-old son at home. And she was absolutely livid. And I've never made that mistake since. If you get the suspense from an audience, from a thing like a bomb, it mustn't go off. Got to be discovered and thrown out of the window. You've got to relieve that suspense in an audience. Otherwise they get angry with you. It's a strange.
You can't kill children or dogs either, can you?
No, no. But the main thing is you cannot, suspense must be relieved. Now, this brick door. Now I got that idea from 21 Club in New York. They had a door down below when it was a speakeasy. There was a brick wall outside, couldn't tell. They had a small wire indicating it and it swung open. So I copied that idea from a real New York speakeasy. Now later on when they get the woman, they do eventually get the woman, medium. And her boyfriend arrives here, sees a car outside, keys in the car. A trickle of paint that she's kicked over in her struggle. They've given her the needle and put her down in this room and locked her in. Now he gets through a back window and goes right by that wall and the whole audience knows she's in there. So there's the suspense. Don't go by there. They want to call out and tell him, she's in there, behind that brick wall. He's searching, calling her all over the place. Meanwhile, the other two are on their way back. They've delivered the bishop. Now, he's going to be caught in their house. He as well. They've already caught the woman. He's going to be caught. So you get your suspense that way. And eventually, what they're going to do, they're going to dispose of the woman by putting her in her own car without the country and running a hose from the exhaust into the car to make it look like suicide. Mm-hmm. And they make all preparations to do that. But she's lying apparently out.
Do you think the ending of Frenzy was too complicated for the audience?
Not really. It was a twist ending. Yeah. You know, he thought he was going to have his revenge and Kill the red-haired man, because he killed, not killed, but he was aiming his blows at a...
At a corpse.
At a corpse, yeah. But the audience were worried when our friend, the taxi driver, gets into this house. He'll be standing right outside that wall. You know, they'll literally, I hope. Anyway, she's in there. But there's nothing to show.
I don't want to hold you up, but just a couple more questions. Does anybody remember, does the audience remember the ending of Psycho, or do they just remember Tony Perkins being
MS? They don't remember the explanation.
No, they don't.
No, I wouldn't think so. No. They remember, they remember high spots in the main shower scene.
It's just left my mind. Oh, the birds. Do you think that ended as it should have? Because the audience seemed like they needed some explanation.
Question, when are you... Well, there was no explanation any more than there is for the bats in the Carlsbad caverns. It's a rabies situation, really. The birds have got rabies. But it's a form of rabies, you know, it's in the air. It's not done by physical contact. In Carlsbad caverns, all the bats have got rabies there, but it's in the atmosphere, rather than one biting the other or anything like that, as in dogs or other animals.
I get the feeling that the audience would have liked the lovebird to be the leader, or some explanation for...
Well, you know, how far do you go? I mean, you know, one... Ready?
Ready.
Does one go on till you get to the Golden Gate Bridge? And show it covered with birds?
Well, you were going to do that, weren't you?
Too much.
Too much money, or too much in terms of psychological, or...?
Well, you know, no, the fault was, you better stop somewhere. Where do you go beyond that? Now, in Daphne du Maurier's idea, the birds were all over the world, were taking over. That, you know, that science fiction.